Good afternoon, everybody. This is Bill Clifford, President of the World Affairs Councils of America in Washington, D.C., and we're delighted to bring you our April edition of our monthly author series, Cover to Cover. This month, we're featuring Daniel Markey, who is a senior research professor at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies, where he is the academic director of CICE Global Policy Program. In 2007 to 2015, Markey was a senior fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia at the Council on Foreign Relations. And while there, he wrote a book on the future of the U.S.-Pakistan relationship called No Exit from Pakistan, which was published in 2013. Dr. Markey's new book is China's Western Horizon, Beijing, and the New Geopolitics of Eurasia, which we'll delve into in a moment. Previously, he served in government at the State Department, where he held the portfolio for South Asia in the Secretary's policy planning staff. That was from 2003 to 2007. And prior to that, he was at Princeton University. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. We're, you know, we have more than 230 registrants. Normally, it's around 100 participants, and that's a great call. So COVID is helping out, but there's great interest in your book. And what people may not know is that amid all the China-centric literature there is focusing on Beijing's ambitions and policies, you really flip it. And you're talking about Eurasia, specifically the subregions of South Asia, Central Asia, and the Middle East, with a focus on Pakistan, Kazakhstan, and Iran. And so it's great that we're going to hear the sort of regional and sub-regional perspective. But just to set the conversation going, I would like to have your take on what is motivating China, what it says it wants, what it really wants, if it's different from what it says it wants, and how these outcomes are likely to be shaped due to the sort of domestic and sub-regional circumstances.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, let me reiterate, I'm glad to join you on the call, and I'm glad to hear that there is something good about COVID and that a lot of people have also joined in. So jumping right into it, you're right, at the core of the book is this idea that it isn't just a matter of what Beijing or China wants in the world, defining how its behavior is shaped in its nearby neighborhood, but it also, a lot of what really matters more than that is what its neighbors actually want, even some of its smaller and, you might say, weaker neighbors. And so the book really focuses on that. But you do have to begin with a recognition, as the book does, that China is different now and that China is exerting itself on the world, including in parts of Eurasia, again, the focus of the book, but everywhere else too, in ways that it hasn't before. And so it is right to ask, sort of, what does China want? What is China up to? As you have. And I think at the core of it is a sense that China does want to reshape parts of the world, some of the rules of action, and reshape, and I think in important ways, what we've come to know as a liberal world order. But it's doing so in a somewhat more evolutionary way, and it's doing so with an economic foot first. So what we've thought about a lot, I think probably all the callers, all the people who have called into this have heard of the Belt and Road Initiative, a vast global effort to increase China's economic involvement and especially its involvement in infrastructure investment. That's a leading element of China's new influence and power and what it's trying to do. But as the book also tries to point out, behind that will be political and possibly in many cases even military and security implications of that, which will extend China's influence in places that are of concern to me and I think should be of broader concern, including the ones you've named, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Iran, across that swath of continental Eurasia, that leads all the way from East Asia to Europe.
And what do you think that the leaders and people of the Eurasian region expect and desire from China? Is it just a cash cow for them? Are there strategic things to gain for them within the region for domestic political purposes? How do you break that down?
All of the above. And I think the critical thing to recognize here is the diversity of interests across the region and the specificity of those interests. That is, each country, each leader, each interest group within various countries is looking for something different, has different expectations from China. But those expectations really are shaped by their own agendas, the shape and content of their political institutions. And so we need to kind of peel it apart bit by bit, country by country, to recognize what they're actually up to. And so to simplify those matters, because the complexity here is vast, right? To simplify this a bit, what I try to do in the book is first look at what I call domestic political economy. That is, within each society, what do leaders and various important interest groups within those states, what do they want from China? And often, as you hinted at, it is that they're hoping to make some money. They're hoping to cement their roles and power in positions of leadership within their societies. They're hoping to do better than their neighbors. In a sense, they're hoping to be the winners out of whatever China has to offer. And again, starting with economics, but then also in terms of political influence and even security affairs. So that's part one. And then part two is, in each of these states that I look at, there's also a very important kind of regional competition or geopolitical competition that these states are already engaged in. They already have relationships. So, for instance, Pakistan's relationship with India or Iran's relationship with Saudi Arabia, they're already involved in these competitions. And so their leaders, and in many cases their political and military institutions, are looking to benefit from their relationship with China, to harness that relationship in ways that will help them better compete with those neighbors than they have in the past. It's not rocket science, but I think it's important to recognize that these localized interests really drive outcomes in ways that might be different from what we might expect if China alone were making determinations about what to do in the region on the basis of its own interests alone. These states are able to shape the contours of the opportunities that China has before it.
Well, you're not explicit about it, but you do in the book really almost take a case study approach, I think. And to go to one that you open the book with, which is the Gwadar port, a deep sea port on the Arabian Sea in southwestern Pakistan, in the Balochistan province. There is a great example of something that was really underway before Belt and Road Initiative and has presented China with problems that are not what it purports BRI to be, which is all about comity and mutual benefit and common prosperity. Talk about the sort of arc of this port, Gwadar Port.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I opened the book with it for precisely this reason, because I think it is so illustrative of the point that I'm trying to make about local interests driving the opportunities that are available to China. So, you know, I've had an opportunity a few years ago to have a conversation with former president, former, many would say, dictator, Pervez Musharraf, leader of Pakistan, and to ask him what he was thinking when he pushed the idea of getting the Chinese to sign on to build out the infrastructure for this port along the Arabian Sea, all the way back, even before 2001, in 1999. And his answer was that he had very specific strategic purposes. He wanted to have a port, and he wanted the Chinese specifically there to help him because he thought this would be a means potentially to evade some kind of Indian blockade of Karachi port, also on the Arabian Sea, and also to place greater pressure on India in the region and to show that China had Pakistan's back. So for all of those reasons, he reached out to Beijing to ask them to help him build this port. And the reaction, at least the initial reaction from China, was one of surprise. They couldn't believe that somebody was, that he was serious about trying to build a port basically in the middle of nowhere, in a very undeveloped part of Pakistan, which has for decades now experienced kind of insurgency, separatist movements, and violence. So they went back and they said, "Are you sure? Is this for real?" And the answer was yes, indeed, he did want that, but for his own reasons. Well, to kind of encapsulate a somewhat longer story, over years the Chinese did invest in it, but it didn't amount to much, and it was only rekindled again with the Belt and Road and the Pakistan piece of that, China-Pakistan economic corridor. The Chinese came back in and dumped additional investment in it. It still isn't commercially viable as far as anybody can tell. But now, you know, nearly 20 years later or thereabouts, you begin to see the potential that this piece of territory could also serve China's own strategic aims, not least to have an overland route across Pakistan into the Arabian Sea for projecting Chinese military power sometime in the future, should they choose and should the Pakistanis allow them to use that. And so you see this interplay between Pakistan's own interests, China leading with investment, in this case infrastructure investment, and with the potential that over time this could evolve into being something that will have a strategic consequence for China itself. And that's a story that I think, although that specific story doesn't repeat again and again, versions of that repeat again and again across the region.
Well, I'm interested in moving forward with this example, or maybe you can draw on others. In respect to China's ideology, or maybe we can compare it to things that the U.S. has done in the past when it has provided investment or aid and touting U.S.-American values along the way. Does China do that? Is it about authoritarianism, or are there things that they're bringing along with it that may be repressive, or do they put, is it all just about, you know, finding avenues for Chinese workers?
I think, that's a great question. I think that there's an interplay a shift going on in terms of China's own attitudes about its overseas involvement, a shift that is leading it away from a stricter adherence to a non-interference policy that it's touted over decades, suggesting that China really only cares about commercial exchange and doesn't have an ideological motivation, and beyond that, isn't going to get involved in the neighborhood's own domestic politics. And now we're seeing China and Beijing engage in debates over things like what they've been described as creative or constructive engagement, where they'll be more heavily involved in the politics of the region. And then the question is, well, what does that actually look like? And I don't think that it's strictly ideological. That is, I don't think that Beijing has a sense that its one-party communist party system should be implemented elsewhere, but it also doesn't have any interest in seeing norms of democracy or liberal values flourish in its neighborhood, and if anything, is more than happy to export the tools of repression that a number of its neighbors, who are themselves already either autocratic or leaning autocratic or illiberal, are more than happy to take advantage of. So in a country like Iran, they've clearly bought Chinese technologies, which will allow them to better control the internet, better to surveil their own people, better to crack down on any kind of social media use, either people that might allow them to mobilize against the state. And similar types of efforts, I think, are underway elsewhere in the region. And so it's not so much the export of Chinese communist ideology, but it is far more politically interventionist or certain types of interference than what China would suggest it's up to. And it tends to support the most illiberal or repressive autocratic elements that are already pretty strong across that region and I fear are getting stronger.
Great. We're talking to Daniel Markey, Senior Research Professor at Johns Hopkins SAIS and the author of China's Western Horizon. I'm going to ask one more question, but I want to prep our listeners to become participants by saying that you can press star 6, introduce yourself and your council affiliation to ask a question of Dan Markey. And I have email questions too, just in case. And you can write me at bclifford@worldaffairscouncils.org. So, Dan, what do the new geopolitics of Eurasia mean for the United States? And to what extent does China's capacity to influence these governments or be pulled in by these countries in Central and South Asia and the Middle East to maybe alter or block U.S. initiatives?
Well, there are a lot of different pieces to this, and I do try to make my way through them in the last chapter of the book. But at the core here is in the short term or short and medium term, I think U.S. policymakers really need to begin to think about, in ways that they never have before, to think about China's involvement in this region in every time that we are engaged in an activity, say in terms of our dealings with Iran or Saudi Arabia or in Central Asia or South Asia. China needs to be on our agenda in terms of what is Beijing up to, what are they seeking to accomplish, are there opportunities for us to partner with them, and in some cases there may well be, for instance, in the India-Pakistan conflict, and are there ways in which Beijing's activities ongoing are likely to get in our way and make our lives even more difficult, such as in terms of trying to crack down on and implement sanctions against the leadership in Iran. So we have to think about China in a part of the world that I think American policymakers haven't been familiar with in the past. But then over the longer term, I think there's also an issue of to what extent China's involvement in continental Eurasia and its extension of its influence there, its access there, its capacity for projecting military power across that region, to what extent will that enhance its ability to compete with the United States globally? And so we need to be balancing those short-term concerns about areas where we may need to work with or in some cases against China and a longer-term concern about how its influence across the region will play into that global competition that we all, I think, increasingly, certainly in Washington, are used to thinking of ourselves being in with Beijing. And it's that game. Now, in terms of it, in a nutshell, how do we begin to do that? Coming back to the beginning, it's a recognition that each one of these efforts has to be, from our part, has to be undertaken with an eye to the local rather than the global. That is, with an understanding of what these individual states, what they're up to, what they want from us, what they want from China. In most cases, what I have found is they care relatively little about our global competition with China, and they care a great deal about their local interests and aspirations and how we might be helpful or harmful to those. And so we need to speak in those terms. We need to understand what those things are and act in ways that are sensitive to those interests rather than trying to frame our involvement in the region or our relations with these countries in terms of U.S.-China competition, because they aren't they don't care a great deal about that, and they aren't likely to be terribly sympathetic to us if we do so. And I might add, I think that the current administration, the Trump administration, tends to be erring in precisely that way, approaching countries such as Kazakhstan and raising concerns about what China is up to, rather than approaching countries like Kazakhstan and saying, you know, what is it that the United States might do to better partner with you in areas that are of most interest to the people of Kazakhstan, which I think would be much more effective.
And that is a great note to councils for when we convene digitally or, you know, hopefully in the near future again in person, to have Eurasian representatives so that we can understand their perspectives and their perspectives on China, because that will be central to American success. Okay, questions for Dan Markey. Press star 6 and please introduce yourself.
Hello.
Hello?
No. Okay, oh. Go ahead. The latter first and then the former. Lady first.
Oh, well, hi. This is Karina Van Vliet with the Cleveland Council on World Affairs. That was super interesting. And I was wondering what your assessment, do you have any idea of how China is prioritizing the expansion of its influence to the West versus to the Southeast, which we had prior, you know, which we'd heard a lot about?
Great question. I think that it's pretty clear to me that the Southeast, that is the eastern seaboard of China, is the area of its greatest concern, right? Because that's where, frankly, U.S. Involvement, both in terms of alliance relationships and also economic and military activities, are most intense. That's where China has some of its most competitive and difficult regional relationships, and that's where it has invested the greatest amount of its military hardware and places its security posture. So I think that's undoubtedly the area of its greatest prioritization. However, Chinese strategists, including some who have been quite close to President Xi Jinping, have recognized also that the West offers some significant opportunities for China, in part because the United States has claimed that it is shifting away from the West, as the Obama administration announced a pivot to Asia, as even the Trump administration has also attempted to try to shift greater focus onto East Asia and the Pacific. Chinese strategists have taken note, and they recognize that if the United States is pulling out of continental Eurasia, including parts of the Middle East, and has relatively less presence in Central Asia, maybe that's an opportunity for China to extend its access and influence westward. And so I wouldn't suggest that the west of China is more important to Beijing, but it's an area of potential opportunity. It has less in the way of, they believe, natural hostility to Beijing as compared to, say, Japan or Korea or even Vietnam. And it has significant access to or resources in terms of specifically energy, hydrocarbons, and so on. And it, in the fullness of time, offers overland access all the way to Europe. So a lot to recommend it. And that's captured the imagination and attention of policymakers in Beijing.
Great. And Karina, by the way, is a fellow CISER. Next question, please.
Great.
Hi. This is Ed Martins from World Boston.
Great.
Go ahead, Ed.
And I'd like to go back a little bit to Pakistan. There's right now, China is repressing the Muslim Uyghurs, and Pakistan is going through, to say the least, you would call it maybe an Islamic revival. I wonder if you see any problems with it. China's making a big push into Pakistan, building that port, et cetera, in that area. And I wonder if you see that might lead to some kind of conflict there, if you could comment on that.
Yeah, this is an important question, and it's not just limited to Pakistan. I mean, if you think about it,
that's true.
Across the region, you know, China is trying to have better relations. I mentioned Iran, but also Saudi Arabia, even Kazakhstan. What China is doing in Xinjiang with respect to the Uyghurs in terms of repression, these so-called re-education or even concentration camps, is the kind of thing that you would anticipate that the Muslim world would respond violently, negatively to. And so it's quite surprising the degree to which there's been relative silence out of many of these countries. When asked Pakistan's leaders, for instance, including its current prime minister, if they don't go silent, at least they refuse to be harshly critical of China in ways that they have been critical of the United States in terms of our involvement in the Muslim world. They do not do the same for the Chinese. So the question is why? And the answer is fairly clear, at least to me, which is they recognize that the reaction from Beijing would be extremely harsh. They are beholden to China in terms of loans, in terms, in the case of Pakistan, a lot of their military supply and support comes from China. And they know that to pick a fight on Xinjiang or other hot-button issues, Tibet, Taiwan, and so on, would be strategically unwise. And so they basically muzzled the opposition to what the Chinese are doing in Xinjiang. And this translates to other places as well. Even in Saudi Arabia, when asked, Saudi leaders are reluctant to criticize China on a point that you would think they would be highly critical of the Chinese for. One last point on this, which is that the publics within these societies are actually quite a lot more, in some cases, a lot more upset with China than their leaders are, and a lot less bound by concerns about strategic interest in some cases, and a lot angrier. And so there's an opposition movement, advocacy organizations, and so on within Kazakhstan that have come up that are shedding light on what's actually happening in Xinjiang and making that public. And there are others, including you can read about in Iran, who are taking to task their own leaders, their clerics, for not speaking up against what the Chinese are up to. So this is a cleavage that's likely to widen as the Chinese continue to be repressive in Xinjiang between the peoples, the publics within these societies, and their leaders. That plays very much into the kind of Islamist revival that you mentioned at the outset of the call, and could make it even worse.
Great. We have time for a couple of questions, and I have two that I'm going to ask at the very end because they're COVID-related, but please go ahead.
Okay.
I have Nancy Hamlin, Rochester, New York.
Hi, Nancy.
Unmuted?
Nope, you're there. I can hear you.
I can hear you.
Yeah, okay. I wasn't sure because I was trying to get in a little bit before. As part of this Belt and Road, which we all understand is economic-driven, is there any systemized and constant propaganda effort that's directed as part of that anti-U.S.?
Sorry, I think I heard you right. Is there a systematic or
a
propaganda?
Strategic effort, anti-U.S. propaganda as part of this Belt and Road effort to reach all
yes.
the fingers out into the world?
Got it. Well, there is a broad propaganda effort by Beijing. It isn't solely anti-U.S. In most cases, I think it tends to be framed more as pro-China than anti-U.S. But there are elements of it that are very clearly anti-U.S. that consistently kind of poke a finger into Washington's eye intentionally. There's one character in particular who, if you're curious for anti-U.S. Flame-throwing, he is currently a deputy, or he's a spokesperson for the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and he has he's quite active online, including on Twitter, but he repeatedly calls into question what the United States is up to, and has even trafficked in some of the conspiracy theories about the origins of COVID-19 coming from the U.S. military and so on. So this he's not just a BRI guy. He's now been elevated to a position of significant authority in Beijing. But before that, he practiced his propaganda and especially his use of social media in Pakistan, where he was the number two at the embassy there. And it was seemed to me, as I was watching it unfold there, as a bit of a kind of a trial effort to see a practice, see if he could be effective at this type of social media propaganda And I guess he was judged to be highly effective, so he's been promoted. So yeah, it's not just you anti-U.S., but there are elements of it. One last piece of this, and I think it's worth understanding, is the Belt and Road Initiative and a lot of Chinese efforts are intended to paint China, of course, in the very best light, and to show that what China is up to is, as the Chinese tend to say, win-win. Everybody comes out ahead. And to suggest that if you work with China, you can do well. There's no downside to it. It tends to overstate the benefits, understate some of the negative things that come out of it, often high debt, some environmental degradation, the use of Chinese workers, profits often accruing to Chinese companies and so on. Of course, none of that comes out in this kind of propaganda. And it's intended to show that China has a model of success that may be, if contrasted with the United States, significantly better than working with the Americans.
Great. Dan, I have...
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to ask questions. I'm going to pass these questions on. One from Don Samford in Peoria asks, what is the effect of coronavirus and the global economic slowdown on China's westward expansion? And from Jessica Roby in Kentucky, during the time of COVID, a large part of the world is looking to China on how to deal with the pandemic and gain information from the ground level. How much influence will China gain from the Eurasian region? And will the sales of tools of oppression and similar technologies increase not just in the region, but more broadly throughout the world?
So the question about the first aspect of this, will COVID extend or slow China's expansion in continental Eurasia? A version of that was being asked before COVID. That is, the Chinese economy was slowing down. There were a number of questions about whether it could afford the Belt and Road Initiative and other kind of overseas investments in quite the same way as it had before. And now one could say, well, the global economy is in free fall, and obviously this is going to have negative implications for China's economy as well. And so it should be a time in which we might anticipate China would turn inward and deal with its problems at home. I think that's a reasonable argument, and it could well be. But a different way to look at it is, the economy and politics and all of these things are all relative. And China seems to have entered COVID first and may well be exiting first or early as well, which puts it in an advantageous position in terms of dealing with the rest of the world and having the wherewithal internally to take advantage of the opportunities that present themselves. And its Western neighbors, like many of the other countries in the world, especially developing world, are terribly unprepared to deal with this pandemic and are going to suffer, I think, by any reasonable estimate, going to suffer a great deal more than the rest of us. And that should present opportunities for external influence if anybody has the resources and, again, the wherewithal to take advantage of those opportunities. I think Beijing will. I think it will attempt to. I think that if the United States can find its own way out of this crisis and to a position of greater global leadership, we would be also inclined to want to both help out countries in need, but also to use that as an opportunity to demonstrate what the United States and what U.S. leadership can and should be about. And so, but right now we're in the midst of it, and I would say China's at least a half step ahead. It will then be able to export both the masks and other medical supplies in the short term that may buy it some influence overseas, but also over the longer term, it will potentially be in a position to help these countries bail out of economic depression, buy up assets on the relative cheap, and extend its political influence by way of economic influence in countries that maybe even up until now weren't quite so eager to work with the Chinese. So, you know, if it plays out that way, this ultimately would redound to the benefit of an extension of Chinese influence, even at a point where China itself will be suffering from a global economic downturn.
Dan, we've exceeded our time with you, but for the benefit of the recording, if you are willing, I would love for you to elaborate as a final thought on the American strategic options. You sort of present a spectrum and recommendations at the end of the book, ranging from benign neglect to militarized competition. Could you spend a couple minutes in closing to talk about what the U.S. response to China's influence and efforts in the Eurasian landmass should be?
Sure, yeah, it's you've portrayed it exactly right. There are a spectrum of options. On the one end would be to basically say, you know, this is a part of the world that is distant from the United States, where we have, in relative terms, less influence or even access, fewer allies, fewer economic interests. And so perhaps throughout much of continental Eurasia, especially some of the places where the United States knows less well, like Central Asia, we should back away and allow the Chinese to exert greater pressure and have their sphere of influence. And there may be positive benefits to this as well. Our absence will not necessarily endear the region to the Chinese and perhaps would make them even more critical of China. And China may find itself in a very messy and difficult place. And this will be a quagmire type situation for Beijing that will be costly to it. And then at the other end of the spectrum, just jumping to militarized competition, we could imagine a situation where the United States will need to beef up, certainly over the medium to long term, its presence, its military presence in parts of continental Eurasia, including the Middle East, to push back on Chinese influence or access in ways that could be quite costly to us, but which we would find necessary because we would be in this global competition with a Eurasian-sized China, or a China that has access to the resources, including especially the energy resources, of that much wider swath of territory. And we would have to be prepared to deal with that in a more robust way. In between these two extremes, I think, is where the action will really be in terms of having to pick and choose our opportunities to try to work with potential closer partners, say with India, where it makes sense, and to see those relationships very much in the context of this global competition with China, but also to recognize that these countries, again, India is an excellent example, they don't care so much about our ability to compete with China, but their own interests and their own concerns, their own wariness about what China's rise means to them. And to work with, say, New Delhi in that instance, to find solutions that are beneficial to them and to us. And then also to look for those opportunities in other parts of the region, again, with countries like Kazakhstan or even Saudi Arabia or Pakistan, where it makes sense. So picking and choosing, always keeping in mind that these countries care more about their own interests than they do about ours, framing our interests in these terms. And that looks more like you might call it a strong point defense or a kind of a targeted asymmetrical response to China, not trying to outbid China wherever it goes, not trying to outspend China with whatever it does, finding targeted opportunities where we can extend our influence or our access where it makes sense, where we can push back against the Chinese or provide an alternative to them where it makes sense, and to do so on the relative cheap, recognizing again that parts of this is a distant part of the world, and we need to bear in mind that we have other priorities, including our treaty allies and our closer friends in Western Europe and East Asia and so on. So that's the kind of spectrum of options that I lay out. And one last point on that. This is obviously an evolving circumstance. America's ability to respond to China globally depends on a lot of things that have nothing to do with continental Eurasia, have a great deal to do with our own leadership and getting our house in order at home and relating to China and other parts of the world. And so what we do in continental Eurasia will be, I think, in many ways, a subset of that global competition and not a driver of it. But it's an important subset nonetheless.
I want to thank you, Professor Daniel Markey, for your not only your time with us today, but for your service to the Department of State, also for the research and scholarship you've done at CICE, which has revealed itself in this book, China's Western Horizon, which I commend for not only its scholarship, but its great readability and its neatly organized work. You've really come up with a great book for us, and I'm sure council leaders around our network will want to host you when it's time to do that in person again. I want to thank our audience and let you know that digital programming, not only from WACA, but around the 90 councils, is exploding. We have at 4 p.m. today a WAC New Hampshire Live edition on combating violent extremism with a speaker from our partner, the U.S. Institute of Peace. And I'll be having my team email you about a special program this evening on the COVID crisis in Iran. You'll let us know if we're giving you too many things to listen to or watch via Zoom. But for now, we hope you stay well and pay attention to the world around you. Thanks, everybody. Thanks again, Dan, for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.